I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. By now, you have no doubt heard excerpts of President Trump's Saturday phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Ben Raffensperger and General Counsel Ryan Germany. Or perhaps you listened to the entire hour of Trump pressuring them to find 11,780 votes to overturn the results of the Georgia election and make Trump the winner. Here's a minute from that call.
The ballots are corrupt, and you're going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them, because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard, and they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can. Both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
It is shocking to hear a sitting president try to so blatantly cheat, using false and discredited allegations to subvert the will of the people of Georgia. The votes have been counted three times, and Joe Biden declared the winner. Tomorrow, a dozen Republican senators and more than 100 Republican House members have said they would contest the Electoral College vote count. This action has split the GOP, with a number of Republicans criticizing their colleagues. Senator Ben Sasse said, quote, "This is a grift hitched onto a big lie. It will not work." We have two guests who have joined us. Craig Green is a professor of law at Temple University. Craig, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It's such a great program.
Thank you so much. And Charlie Dent joins us as well. He's a former Republican member of the House of Representatives. He served Pennsylvania's 15th congressional district. He's now a commentator for CNN. Charlie Dent, it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks, Marty. Great to be with you and Craig.
Well, you're very welcome. And let me begin with you, if I could, Charlie Dent. We are used to President Trump defying norms, uttering falsehoods, promoting conspiracy theories. When you listen to this phone call, is this more of the same of what we've had for 4 years, or something different and more dangerous? Charlie Dent.
Yeah, there are consequences to chaos, and you know, who thought it would ever reach this level? I cannot say that I am surprised by this. We all witnessed with our own eyes and ears the phone call with the Ukrainian President Zelensky, where the president asked for a political favor of a foreign head of state, and you know, and conditioned foreign aid as part of the deal. I mean, we've seen this before, but it's just so blatant, and it's you know, this is beyond offensive. It's beyond absurd or inappropriate. This is grotesque and an obscenity to representative government and democracy itself. I mean, our whole system of government. I mean, I just, you know, you kind of run out of words to describe this. I mean, to overturn an election, could you imagine if a congressman or any elected official had made a call like this to a county or a state election official, telling them, hey, I need 5,000 votes. You know, I believe I won, therefore I did. So just find me the 5,000 votes and all will be good. And if law enforcement were to have discovered this, of course they would be prosecuted, or they'd certainly be investigated. You know, it depends whether or not it's a crime, but it certainly looks like it violates all sorts of not just norms and traditions, but statutes, both federal and state. So I'm just you're almost at the point where you kind of run out of words. And then what's even more stunning about that call with the Secretary of State Raffensperger and his general counsel, Ryan Germany, he basically told them that if you don't join me in this conspiracy to overturn the election, you will, in fact, be guilty of a crime. In other words, because they're not overturning the election, they're engaged in criminal behavior. I mean, wow, up is down, down is up. I mean, your head's just ready to explode listening to this.
Well, Well, I want to get back to you, Charlie Dent, but let me get you in on the conversation, Craig Green. And we really heard both of those things in that clip. One where he says, you know, this could be a crime if you don't find these votes and don't overturn the election. Craig Green, what did you hear in this call?
Yeah, I think this is both different and more of the same. This is the kind of abuse of the presidency that manifested many times before and, of course, has influenced Representative Dent not to support Trump, and many other Republicans haven't. But there's a part of it that's a concern about this president, at least for a couple more weeks, and what he's capable of. And he's shown us what he's capable of time and again. Another concern, which I think is a little bigger, is this time an awful lot more important people are in on it. So, of course, Raffensperger hasn't just fielded one nasty phone call from a Republican. This is at least the second. Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, very soon after the election, called to pressure Raffensperger to toss out all mail ballots legally cast and then denied it, which is the reason, by the way, this phone call was recorded.
That's right.
Because Raffensperger wasn't going to be fooled again. And I think the idea, of course, there have been other controversies about Electoral College. Electoral College is the core of electing the president of the United States. And there have been other objections, but the idea that a dozen senators of the United States would endorse this kind of stuff is really troublesome, and I think it's come so close to the possibility of the most damaging layer, which is the public. You had a rally last night in Georgia with tens of thousands of people supporting the president as he ran through roundly and repeatedly debunked falsehoods and lies about numerical facts about Georgia's election, with cheers accompanying periodically. And, of course, there's the possibility of potentially violent, we hope they're not, protests, in Washington, D.C. and maybe elsewhere. This is the language you'd also had in the clip about the people are angry and what are they supposed to do? Of course, there have been death threats and all sorts of things. This is really, it goes beyond norm violation. It goes beyond democracy attack, and people really are being threatened and possibly worse.
Charlie, there's so much to talk about, but let me go back to you and because you are a Republican. As you look at how this has divided the Republican Party, you've got Raffensperger, you've got Gabriel Sterling, you've got Ryan Germany from Georgia and others who are pushing back, essentially saying to the president, you are not correct when you make these allegations. You do have a dozen members of Congress, they're going to, of the U.S. Senate, they're going to contest the Electoral College vote tomorrow. There are Republicans pushing back on that. How much has the president split your party apart?
Well, he's done enormous damage. He's done enormous damage to the party. Right now, I've often felt that there was going to be a reckoning after this election, particularly if President Trump lost, which he did. But that reckoning, I think, has been a little bit muddled in that, Republicans did well down ballot. So and I think the president right now is having a very difficult time accepting the rejection of him by the voters while affirming so many Republicans down ballot. I think this is really, just kind of set him off into a really dark and dangerous place. But the party right now, you have, I'll say, the adults, Pat Toomey and Brian Fitzpatrick locally, who are, standing up and doing the right thing and saying the right things. And Mitch McConnell is pushing back very hard, as John Thune, Liz Cheney, and even Tom Cotton, is pushing back on this mad dash to this kamikaze mission, this Lemmings with suicide vest routine.
That's how you see it? That's how you see it?
Well, yeah, I see this as why would anybody join this adventure to go and, try to overturn an election? They're saying that all these states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, that these are corrupt elections. The incoherence of the argument is such that if the Democrats are trying to steal the election, the presidential election, why wouldn't they steal everything down ballot? Why wouldn't they take it all? This doesn't make any sense to suggest that the presidential election was fixed in a fraud, and then to say that everybody below them, their races were somehow clean. This doesn't make any sense. So you have the adults, it's McConnell and Toomey and Fitzpatrick and there are others. And then you have this other group that is, basically facilitating and enabling the president's very dangerous obsession which is a frontal assault on our whole notion of representative government.
Well, and Craig Green, that begs the question, why? I mean, is it for short political calculation? I mean, Ben Sasse had a pretty extensive response and critique talking about ambitious politicians thinking it's a quick way to tap into the president's populist base. How do you see what's going to be happening tomorrow in the Congress?
Right. I mean, there is a war for the GOP and the Republican Party, and the only thing I would add about that is that if it's the adults in the room, there aren't enough adults and they've come too late. I think there's no reason to mingle together Charlie Dent, who was against Donald Trump in 2016 and remains against him today, with Mitch McConnell, who continued to raise doubts about the election for weeks after the election only recently come around. Credit for coming around, but it's a little late. You have secretaries of defense who have, including Trump's own secretaries of defense, who have now gone on record opposing him. But it is a little late. And the damage that's done and the damage that will be done tomorrow goes beyond the Republican Party and goes beyond the sort of appeal to populist politics. It goes to an attack on truth. The really distressing thing is the more evidence has come forward and the more investigations have been performed, the misstatements and falsehoods and lies become more extravagant and more untrue. And that kind of reaction goes beyond just winning short-term political balance. It's more about trying to persuade people with some success that there is no such thing as truth to be known, and that all of the facts that are apparent, there's no shredding of ballots. Of course there's no shredding of ballots. But actually, millions of people think there are. There is shredding of ballots. And this idea that of a detachability of political institutions from truth is what's at risk tomorrow. You have people who are going to make arguments that are not just the arguments they're making, they're in a bigger context. And this bigger context is a legitimation of a falsehood, and deliberate falsehood and repeated falsehood, and that damage to the American political, they're not going to succeed anything tomorrow in blocking the certification of Pennsylvania's votes or turning around Georgia's election. The Georgia state officials, Pennsylvania state officials have stood strong, as indeed has Senator Toomey. But the bigger damage is to America. And, in another part of the call that you didn't have a chance to play is Trump says this is not just about social media. He says, quote, this is, quote, Trump media. And that idea that people are getting their information from fundamentally corrupt and abusive sources, unlike CNN, unlike NPR, unlike Fox News. Fox News got attacked in the Georgia rally last night. I mean, this is really pushing more and more Americans to the margins of truth-telling and bringing in all kinds of voices that should not be taken as seriously as they have been for far too long.
Let me pick up on that and go back to you, Charlie Dent. I was watching Gabriel Sterling yesterday. He's one of the Georgia representatives who is in charge of the election, where he did a point-by-point fact-check takedown of all the things that were in that phone call about dead people and teenagers and out-of-staters and felons and shredded ballots and this video that we don't have time to go into. And yet we hear something like, 80, most Republican voters think that this election was stolen.
Yeah.
You know what? Hold on to that thought. I totally lost track of time because I'm so invested in this conversation. We'll get your answer, Charlie Dent, after this very short break. And do stay with us. Normally, I have my eyes on my watch, but I took it off. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about President Trump's phone call on Saturday pressuring Georgia's Secretary of State to find votes to overturn the election. Craig Green with us, professor of law at Temple University. Charlie Dent, former Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Pennsylvania. He's a commentator now for CNN. Let me play one more clip, and then, Charlie, I want to get a response from you. And this, again, goes back to the phone call with between Georgia's Secretary of State and President Trump. Let's give it a quick listen.
The people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, that you've recalculated.
And Raffensperger follows up by saying, Mr. President, the data that you have is wrong. Charlie, let me get your response to the fact that there's been such an effort coming from members of the Georgia government basically trying to fact check what the president says. And yes, and yet we still have so many members, voters of the Republican Party, who think that Biden was falsely elected president. How do we deal with that?
I think what's happened is that Republican voters have heard one version of what Donald Trump considers to be the truth, which we all know is false. And so I think what needs to happen is Republican voters need to hear an alternative narrative, which is the actual truth. That is that there was an honest election conducted, not just in Georgia, but in Pennsylvania and other states. That's not to say there aren't ever any voter irregularities or occasional, incidental incidents of voter fraud or isolated incidents. I mean, sure, that happens. But it was a clean election. I mean, the Trump administration said so itself. Mr. Krebs, who was fired for saying it at the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, Homeland Security, said it was a clean election. So Republican voters need to hear the truth from prominent Republican elected officials in large numbers. And I think if there's an alternative narrative out there, that will change these dynamics. And I think that is really the bigger problem here and the damage that the president is doing. A lot of people are, a lot of ordinary Americans that say, hey, the president says something, it should be true, right? Or it must be true. Those who support him. And I think that's really the damage here. This president's assault on the truth and on fact, is probably going to be the most damaging part of his legacy.
Let me go back to you, Craig. From your perspective as a law professor, were any laws broken in that phone call?
Well, I think the ordinary way of holding presidents accountable for such egregious behavior is impeachment, and that feels a little late. So I think talking about criminal prosecution, the real question, I think, would be whether one could prove that President Trump was disbelieved all the things he was talking about. Because, of course, if he's asking to find the votes and he knows they're not there, that's election fraud. If he says find the votes and he thinks they are there, it wouldn't be. So for criminal prosecution, I think beyond reasonable doubt, it would be pretty hard to prove. But just to stress it, that's the wrong neighborhood. That's the wrong neighborhood to be thinking about. It is a disgrace, the idea that one would have to contemplate whether or not an outgoing president would be committing election fraud on the way out the door. There have been plenty of presidents who have lost, some of them several times, and this is just not an appropriate way to behave. And I think the biggest problem is that, in a way, I keep setting new deadlines and new goalposts for when things are supposed to go back to normal. Oh, maybe it's when Fox News calls the election. Oh, maybe it's when the states certify the electoral votes. Oh, maybe it'll be when Congress accepts the votes, which of course they will do tomorrow. But I think the troublesome thing is that although there are people like Charlie Dent and, of course, John Kasich and some other number of folks who have been trying to talk this reevaluation of conservatism and Republican Party and what it means, at the same time, you have people like Peter Navarro, who I think yesterday or the day before was saying you could just push the inauguration date off. And, of course, General Flynn, who some weeks ago circulated the possibility that the military would run a new election or something like this. And I just think that as long as there are voices and platforms and believers for that kind of dangerous, damaging nonsense, I think it's very hard to think about going forward. And that's what the Biden-Harris administration, the burden that they carry and hopefully will carry, is trying to restore some sense of truth-telling and also truth-believing, because both are so important.
Well, and let me just add that defense secretaries wrote a letter basically saying that there should not be a military coup here. I'm just summarizing there. Let me toss something back to you, Charlie Dent, and this is something that the president said yesterday about the vice president, who will preside over tomorrow's proceedings, saying, quote, I hope he comes through for us. And then he adds something like, or I won't like him very much. But the idea that I hope he comes through for us, this is a ceremonial position that the vice president has. He doesn't have some secret envelope that he's, hidden somewhere. He just presides over this procedure having to do with electoral votes. Can you speak to that?
Well, yeah, and I'm just looking at a thread on Roll Call from Roll Call. Just now as I'm speaking to you that says Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, the Senate President pro tempore, says he and not Vice President Mike Pence will preside over the certification of electoral votes since we don't expect him to be there. I'm just looking at this off of a roll call thread.
Well, that's interesting.
So I don't know. So maybe the vice president, I don't know. According to Senator Grassley, he's not going to be present in the Senate. We haven't been here before. So this objection that's going to be raised will have to be debated, I believe, in both the House and the Senate. I don't believe this has ever been done before. So the vice president presumably would ordinarily preside in the Senate. You know, who's going to preside in the House? I have to go look at the Article 12 of the Constitution again to look at how that's to be handled. I think we're in a kind of a very unusual and odd. The president is going to put pressure on Mike Pence. I would just assume that Mike Pence will do the right thing and certify the votes. I mean, he can't change anything. I think he has said as much. And I hope that he would follow through, on what he had said previously. But if he's not there, who knows?
That's fascinating. Craig, here's a comment from Helen. I'll just summarize it here. She says, this sounds like the manipulation Trump is accustomed to using with accountants and spreadsheets with his loans, taxes, and real estate deals. I think he believes everything works the way he does his business. And any thoughts about that?
Sure. I mean, there is a stream of argument that's been around for a long time, including my colleague Jonathan Lipson, about how you look at how he ran the casinos, you can tell he runs the government. But I have to say that for me, the disappointment, I think the damage for America will never be about Donald Trump. It'll be about the people who supported and believed in him way, way too late. And I think that's the difference between mismanaging a business or misdirecting your attorneys or accountants and damaging the basis of democracy for long after you're gone. Because the risk is that some number of Americans just simply have become accustomed to disbelieving the truth. And as long as too many Americans do it, too many American politicians are going to do it. And the idea of the grown-ups in the room will have to hope for more grown-ups.
I'm wondering, and picking up on something you said, Charlie Dent, that in dealing with the false information that has been spun from the White House and others, that someone has to speak up. Who is that person that has credibility within the Republican Party who can speak to some of these lies?
Well, instead of 140 members of the House and 12 or so members of the Senate, you know, spinning this this narrative about the objection, you know, you need 140 Republican House members and, you know, dozens of Republican senators to stand up and take the opposite position. I think that's what needs to happen. These are elected officials in high places, whether they be governors, congressmen, senators, legislators. They should be standing up and defending the truth, defending democracy, because I thought that's one thing we could all agree on, that we have an election. And when a winner is declared, we accept the outcome, even if we don't like it. We accept it because that's how we do things in America. And that's what separates us from other countries where people gain power, then they never relinquish it. That's the difference. And that's so sad. And the fact that you just pointed out, too, that defense secretaries have signed a letter, I thought that was a direct shot across the bow of the acting defense secretary, Chris Miller, and these other political appointees at DOD, who they must fear, or may not have the fortitude to stand up and do what they must to protect the military from being involved in this election dispute. The military wants to stay out of it.
We're almost out of time here. Let me just put a quick question to you, Craig Green. We've got 2 weeks before Joe Biden is inaugurated president of the United States. What do you anticipate we're going to be dealing with for the next 2 weeks?
Sure. And Georgians will be heard. I think one thing that's on the ballot is the Trump set of lies about the election. But I think the inauguration and what follows, I think, will be really important and such a test. I have to say my optimism is maybe a little lower perhaps than Charlie Dent's, but you know, Mitch McConnell and the Senate leadership will have a chance to show that they're ready for a unified country and for a country that's ready to move past this era and a country that's ready to return to what Charlie Dent and others would have called Republican values, conservative values, American values, democratic values. they'll have a chance to show that. The alternative, of course, we have seen before in the prior episode of this particular show, which is obstruction and which is damaging and political gamesmanship playing for 2022 and 2024. The last thing the American people need are a bunch of politicians playing for the next election. I think it's about time, and that's what the Biden-Harris ticket ran on. That's the reason a number of Republicans supported them, among other things, is they promised a different vision of unity, of policy, serving the American public for a change. And I think we'll have to see whether that happens. Yeah. Inauguration Day will be the beginning.
That is Craig Green, professor of law at Temple University. Craig, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, and your listeners, too.
Thanks so much. And Charlie Dent, former Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Pennsylvania. He's a commentator for CNN. Charlie Dent, thanks for joining us as well.
Hey, thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. Well, a year ago, who would have predicted that we were on the cusp of a global pandemic? For one, our guest, science writer David Quammen, whose 2012 book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, was about viruses that originate in wild animals that get transmitted to humans with dire consequences. That's what happened with COVID-19, the severe acute respiratory syndrome that has killed more than 350,000 Americans, more than 1.9 million people around the world in the last year. We spoke with David Quammen last spring, and he joins us once again to talk about why we were so unprepared for this virus and how human activities that disrupt the natural world have jump-started recent pandemics. He lives in Bozeman, Montana. David Quammen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you for asking me. Good to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you as well. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. We are obviously shifting gears here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You and other scientists predicted this pandemic, frankly, years ago, sounding the alarm. Why do you think we, and I'll talk about the United States as we, why were we so unprepared?
Well, we were scientifically prepared. I think we were prepared in terms of public health expertise, but we were not politically prepared. There were possible ways of creating pandemic preparedness systems, structures, capacity. Some of those had been put in place first by George W. Bush and then expanded by President Obama. They were dismantled largely during the last 4 years. Why would a particular political leader not want to spend money on pandemic preparedness if scientists are telling him that a pandemic is coming? The only conceivable reason I can think of is that pandemic preparedness is something that costs maybe tens of billions of dollars, and you don't know that the pandemic is going to come between now and the next election. So if you're cynical and calculating, you say, I'm not going to spend that money to prepare for something that might not happen on my watch.
Well, it's interesting to think about how politics and this pandemic have been in conflict. Obviously, 2020 was such a consequential year. Politics are about short-term results, but a pandemic, a virus, that's long-term. That's thinking well into the future.
That's right. And that those tens of billions of dollars that I mentioned in terms of preparedness, that's chicken feed compared to, of course, what COVID-19 has been costing us just in terms of shutting down economies, economic losses, never mind the suffering and death that it's caused. So it was very, very, very false economy.
You've written a lot about viruses and this particular virus, and it seems in that sort of game of survival, viruses are very well suited for our environment. Can you speak to that?
Yes, we live in a world of viruses. There are viruses everywhere. Viruses are genetic parasites. They're not cellular creatures. They can only replicate themselves and complete their life cycles within cells of cellular creatures, meaning animals, plants, fungi, or other microbial cellular creatures. So they need to live in other creatures, and they do. All of the wild animals, all the thousands and thousands of species of wild animals that live in our rich, diverse ecosystems, they carry unique viruses. There are viruses everywhere. So as we come in contact with increasingly with wild animals, as we drain off the resources and destroy the ecosystems where they live, those viruses have an opportunity to get into us. Viruses are subject to the Darwinian imperatives. Replicate yourself as much as possible, spread yourself in geographical space, extend yourself in time. And getting into humans is a great, great way to achieve Darwinian success.
Is that because we're such a good host for these viruses?
Well, not mainly. It's because there are so many of us. We are so abundant and we live in such concentrations. If a virus that's living in an endangered bat species in southern China makes the leap and gets into humans, it has won the sweepstakes. It has gone from being a passenger on a sinking lifeboat to being on a luxury liner, getting into the human population with the opportunity to spread around the world and have 8 billion potential hosts. That is a great career move for a virus.
I'm thinking about this new strain of the coronavirus that has been identified. I mean, they do mutate. Are you worried about that? And apparently it might not be more lethal, but it looks like it's more contagious. Is this what viruses do?
This is concerning. I've been following it. I've been following the scientists who study the molecular evolution of this virus. And actually, there are two new variants of note. One is what's being called the UK variant, and it's got the label B117 coming out of southeastern England. And the other is one coming out of South Africa that has some but not all of the same mutation. So these are bouquets of mutations in each variant that seem to have made the virus more transmissible. There's a new paper just out from scientists in England, the Imperial College London and other institutions, that confirms, yes, this does seem to be more transmissible, and it has arisen in areas where social distancing has been in effect. And people say, well, is the virus evolving? Well, there is a suggestion in this. It's implicit that perhaps the virus has evolved to get around social distancing. Now, that's a spooky idea. That's just a hypothesis at this point, but it is a spooky idea.
It sure is, and I want to pick up on that. That's David Quam, and he's an award-winning science journalist, and we are talking about the pandemic, the virus. We have much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're taking a look at the pandemic about roughly a year since the start of its spread. We do want to talk with our guests about spillover events when animal infections jump to humans and how our activities are making the natural world more dangerous for people and for animals. David Quammen, our guest, he's an award-winning science journalist, author of 16 books, including Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. David, I'm trying to sort of digest what you said right before the break, which is this new, mutant strain of this virus could have the ability to get around some of the mask wearing and social distancing that we have put into place to try to protect us from this SARS virus. If that's true, that would be such a quick adaptation to behavior that not everybody is obviously doing.
Well, it seems quick, but remember, how many cases are there around the world right now? This virus has spread broadly, has been replicating just an uncountable number of times. And the more people a virus spreads to, the more it replicates, the more it mutates, the more it has opportunities to evolve. Now, this particular idea, I want to emphasize again that it's hypothetical. It's only implied in this paper. Maybe I'm reading something into it, but I don't think I am. they are saying that this virus has acquired this ability to be more transmissible in areas where social distancing is strongly in effect. And also this virus affects more people under the age of 20 than the normal, more familiar strain of virus does. So they're cautioning careful thought before the schools in the United Kingdom are reopened now in January. All of these things reminding us that this is an ingenious, not to anthropomorphize it too much,
sure,
but this is a shifty, intricate, ingenious virus that is capable of evolving at that pace.
Let me ask you some really basic questions about this particular virus. Are bats responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic?
First of all, I'd say bats are not responsible, because even if bats are the reservoir host of this virus, the place where it has lived over long stretches of time, bats didn't bring it to us, and the virus didn't seek us out. Viruses don't climb into humans, they spill into humans. So if this came from a bat, which it seems that it did, there's very strong evidence, but not final proof of that, then it's because humans came in contact with that bat in some sort of a way that gave the virus the opportunity to take hold in humans. It's not the fault of bats. It's not even the fault of the virus. It's an ecological interaction initiated by humans that has opened the opportunity for the virus to colonize a new kind of host.
As you have written, bats can carry these viruses, but they don't get sick, or it doesn't kill them. What do they have that we don't have?
That's right. Bats have been identified as the reservoir hosts of a lot of new dangerous viruses that get into humans. SARS-1 in 2002, 2003, Hendra virus in Australia, Nipah virus in Malaysia and Bangladesh, Marburg virus in Africa, probably Ebola virus. So scientists have asked, you know, what is it about bats? And they've answered that question. There are a number of things. First of all, bats live long lives. They roost together in dense aggregations. Both of those are good circumstances for circulating a virus endlessly in a population of bats if it's there. And there are a few other things, chief among which is the fact that bats have different sorts of immune systems. They have immune systems that seem to be more tolerant of peculiar molecular entities in them. And the reason for that probably has to do with the fact that they're the only truly flying mammal. They go through a lot of physiological stress. There are unstable molecules released in their bodies. If they had sensitive immune systems, they might constantly be in a state of autoimmune disease. And so their immune systems seem to have evolved to have sort of a higher threshold of reaction against these suspect molecules, including the suspect molecules on the exterior of a virus.
You talk about spillover and that the virus doesn't seek us out. We move into these environments where either bats are or where the viruses are. And I have to say, almost exactly a year ago, I was in southern Mexico with a friend. This was before the pandemic was announced. We swam in two cenotes, which are underground caves. They are filled with bats. The ceiling's just filled with bats. And on the one hand, I felt this incredible tug to go into this mysterious world. You know, I felt like one of my ancient ancestors. On the other hand, as I think now, I think, how crazy was I to do that?
Yes. Well, I've done some crazy things, too. I did some crazy things when I was researching spillover, including going into some caves looking for bats without PPE. I would do it differently now.
Okay.
Generally, it's a good idea for humans to leave bats alone.
Right.
Yes, because they do carry a lot of viruses that could be dangerous to humans, and because we carry things that are dangerous to them. For instance, the fungus that causes white nose syndrome in North American hibernating bats. It's a terrible plague that's killing off bats all over North America, and it seems to have been brought from Europe probably by humans who went into caves with spores of the fungus on boots or whatever and spread this plague to bats.
So in a sense, let me quote you, David Quammen, rather than make something up. This is one of the things that you wrote in this New York Times piece that you had just a couple of weeks ago. COVID-19 is a disease catastrophe for humans with its likely origin in bats triggered by human action. White nose syndrome that you just mentioned is a disease catastrophic for bats with its origin, who knows where, triggered again by human action. We humans are one species, abundant and wondrous and powerful. Bats are many species, diverse and wondrous and vulnerable. So are in, you know, in this sort of war between bats and people, are we going to win this war? Can we live in a world without bats?
We shouldn't expect to live in a world without bats, and we shouldn't think of it as a war between humans and bats. Bats are not just wondrous creatures, but they're very valuable, important creatures. They serve a lot of ecological functions in our ecosystems. They eat uncountable tons of insects, including agricultural pests. They pollinate trees in our tropical forests. They disperse seeds. They do things. They are part of our ecosystems. We should treasure them. There are 1,400 species of bats, roughly. One in every five species of mammal on planet Earth is a species of bat. The evolution of bats is one of the most majestical phenomena that's ever happened on planet Earth. And so we should respect them, partly by giving them respectful distance, and we should keep them alive and diverse insofar as we possibly can.
And stay out of their habitat?
Yes, and stay out of their habitat, unless there is a very, very good reason to go into their habitat. For instance, to sample bats without harming them, to look for molecular evidence of a virus whose origin we're trying to trace. And tracing the origin of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that causes COVID-19, is a very important scientific question that needs to be solved. And going into bat caves to look for evidence of that is one of the few really legitimate reasons I can think of for humans to be coming into contact with bats.
Let me get a couple of callers. We got, looks like Daniel from Central New Jersey joining us on Radio Times. And Daniel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on the idea that, I mean, the more the virus spreads, the more likely it is to mutate. The only real means we have right now preventing spread is vaccinating. And our government should be mounting a wartime effort to get people vaccinated. It seems to me now that we have vaccines, the problem you hear all over the news is that vaccination is proceeding at a snail's pace. You know, they should be vaccinating thousands and thousands and thousands of people a day, and it doesn't seem to me to be happening. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure, Daniel. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And David Quammen, you want to respond to that?
Well, I agree with Daniel. It's maddening. It's just inexcusable that our federal government has abdicated a role in terms of control of the virus, in terms of guidelines on social distancing and mask wearing, and also in terms of vaccine distribution. It's just been a disastrous abdication of what should have been a federal responsibility, and it's costing lives right now, and as well as delaying the reopening of our economies. It's just uncountenanceable, if that's a word.
We'll make it a word for today's conversation. But does that mean we're losing this, or we just have to get ourselves together now? We got to
deal
with this.
We're fortunate that we have a new administration coming in that's going to take this seriously. We're going to have a president who's not walking around saying, well, this is just going to disappear. This is just the flu. This is going to go away magically. We're not going to have some moronic narcissist in denial about this. We're going to have a new administration that takes it seriously. And I hope that beginning January 20th, there will be a sea change in terms of how the federal government is assuming responsibility, not just for vaccine distribution, but for all aspects of controlling this pandemic and bringing our economies back online and getting our children back into school.
I'm curious. I think I know the answers, but let me just ask you, and then we'll get King from Downingtown to join us. But it's been so clear that science, actual science and scientists have been sidelined and denigrated and undermined by the Trump administration. And I'm just curious, David Quammen, what you think about that.
I agree. That's a very, very serious problem. It's a bigger problem, a longer term problem than COVID-19. This spread of science denial and just the petulant attitude of people that they can choose their own facts, that there are no objective facts, there is no objective truth. Oh, I can go to my channel and get the news with a spin on it that satisfies my biases, and you go to your channel, and I'm just going to deny what you claim are empirical facts. That includes, but is not limited to, the world of science. It's a terrible, terrible problem. We need more science education of our young people. We need more education in critical thinking. And I don't know, I'm not smart enough to tell you, Marty, what the rest of the recipe is for curing that problem. That's a deep socio-political problem that we have to solve.
I agree. Let me get King from Downingtown to join our conversation. And King, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. This is a great conversation, and this is a fascinating topic.
Thank you
for having this guest on.
Absolutely.
I would like to know the guest's position on gain-of-function research, which the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has been warning about for over 10 years on the dangers of possibly having an outbreak from a lab and creating a pandemic. And they believe that COVID-19 might be one of these viruses that escape from one of these labs. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. David, what's your response to that?
That's a very interesting question. Gain of function research is research in a laboratory that usually involves passaging a virus among animals, injecting animals with the virus, taking out samples, injecting more animals so that the virus is passed through a whole series, maybe 20 different generations of an animal, and watching the way it evolves to see if it will evolve perhaps to achieve greater transmissibility. And if so, to identify the molecular changes in its genome that have yielded that greater transmissibility. The rationale is then that gives you some predictive power as to what mutations to watch for. It is very controversial, as King said. It was done a handful of years ago with one of the influenzas, very controversially. And it has been done with coronaviruses, too. There is no evidence that I know of that it was done at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where people are saying that some people are hypothesizing that this virus leaked from a lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There is no evidence for that. There is circumstantial, anecdotal finger pointing. It's a serious question that needs to be examined, but people should remember that that when the scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology are sequencing the genome of a virus that is similar but not too similar to this one, which has been done, they're not doing that with live virus. They're doing that with fecal samples that contain fragments of RNA put together into genome. Anyway, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but gain of function is a legitimate question, but it should not lead people to say, oh, this is a laboratory virus, because there's just absolutely no empirical evidence of that.
Well, David Quammen, I always learn stuff talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're very welcome. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Marty.
Thanks so much. David Quammen joining us by Skype. Again, he's an award-winning science journalist, author of 16 books, including Spillover, Animal Infections, and the Next Human Pandemic. I should add that book was written in 2012. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.